Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 11338, State Route Gomez Lovato, arguing for the petitioner, Sean Lewis, arguing for the respondent, Linda Walton, arguing on the merits.
Good morning, counsel. Are you both ready to proceed today?
Yes.
Okay, so we'll, Mr. Lewis, you'll be going first. We'll give you a warning with 10 minutes to go, so you can reserve that time for your rebuttal, and Ms. Walton will give you a warning with 10 minutes to go in your argument, so you know when you're nearing the end. If you would, please proceed, Mr. Lewis. Thank you.
Good morning again, Your Honors.
Good morning.
I think how I'd like to start first pointing out is there was two issues that I requested for the court to review in this matter from the decision of the Intermediate Court of Appeals. The first issue is Mr. Luis Gomez Lovato, whether or not he knowingly, intelligently waived his right to a jury trial. I think what's interesting to note that in his case, the form was printed in English, and he required a Spanish interpreter during the all court proceedings. And that was his first run-in with the law, so to speak. He had never been in a court of law before. He had never been in any trouble, as noted in the sentencing transcript that was attached to the record on appeal. That was his first time that he had ever been involved with any kind of criminal proceeding, as the court had the attention brought to the trial judge, Judge Torrendo, because when the defense counsel who was at the sentencing requested the 48-hour minimum sentence imposed, the defense counsel, Ms. Lawson, pointed out that that was his first offense and he should only be given the 48 hours. So,
did the court have that information in front of it at the time of the waiver of jury trial?
No, it did not. It was brought to the court's attention subsequently, all the way at the sentencing, which was also the day of trial. And it was a one-day trial in this matter.
Counsel.
Lift the microphone a little higher. Counsel.
Oh, I'm sorry. If you would just put the microphone up so that we could be sure to get a good record. Thank you, sir.
Yes.
By that observation, are you implicitly then stating that that's one of the circumstances that should have been evaluated to determine whether or not the waiver was valid?
That's correct, Your Honor. And there's two salient facts that need to be pointed out. First, Mr. Gomez Lovato had never been involved with the law in any way before, so he was unfamiliar with the difference between a judge trial and a jury trial. And that's a salient fact that goes into the total circumstances as to whether or not there was indeed a knowing and intelligent and voluntary waiver in this case. The second salient fact that goes into play is the case that we cited, the federal case standard, and the Sergio Duarte-Hargitareto. In that case, it's very similar to the case at bar because Mr. Luis Gomez Lovato, he was given a form that was entirely in English, just as the individual in the United States of America versus Sergio case was.
But doesn't the record reflect that that form was interpreted to him by a Spanish-speaking interpreter?
Not in the presence of the court. That was done outside the presence
of the court. But the court confirmed with Mr. Lovato that it had been interpreted to him outside the courtroom. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
But I believe the problem is that comes into is whether he actually understood what he was agreeing to with the difference between a judge trial and a jury trial. There's nothing.
Is there anything to indicate this interpreter was not properly qualified or that he was having any trouble understanding this interpreter?
I think when you look at the transcript and the interaction between the court and the interpreter, it didn't look like it was really given, shall I say, a good amount of consideration as to what exactly he understood, because some things, too, just as a matter of language interpretation, we don't know exactly whether the court interpreter, there's nothing in the record to support that she had interpreted in court cases before, whether or not she understood the difference between judge trial and jury trial.
Why would her understanding matter? Her only job is to translate the form, isn't that right?
Except that when a translator is translating things, some things can be changed by the translation. For example, in Polish, the language, door and doors, it's different whether it's plural or singular in the Polish language versus English. So things like that can come into play.
Well, do we
is
have
there anything on the record to even suggest that the attorney actually went over the jury trial rights with the defendant?
All there is that, if I might just look at the transcript.
Did you discuss this with your attorney? All right. That's the question. Did you discuss this with your attorney?
Yes.
This being prior to placing your initials and signature on this form, did you understand what you were doing and signing?
Yes. And there's nothing to explain whether or not.
Actually, in this case, the interpreter was never sworn, correct?
Well, someone did point out, the clerk pointed out, that the interpreter was sworn previously.
There's nothing to reflect that the judge thought that the interpreter needed to be sworn, and said, you know, when you come back, we'll swear you in again. Okay, all right.
Let me ask you this. How do we know what the interpreter explained to Mr. Gomez-Lobato?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
How do we know what it is, what was explained by the interpreter to Mr. Gomez-Lobato?
That's what the record is completely silent on, and the court only asked Mr. Gomez-Lobato yes-no questions. And that's a problem when it comes to having someone who's unfamiliar with the court system and speaks a different language as to the court simply could have, for such an important constitutional right, the right to jury trial. In the cases of the trials that we see every day in our courts in this state, with the Tachibana colloquy, it's always done twice. Once at the beginning of the case, and then once just before the defendant decides whether or not he's going to testify.
So it could have been garbled by the interpreter. The interpreter could have missed certain portions. I mean, the variety of things that could have happened, and we have absolutely no idea. We're just guessing, in a sense.
That's correct, Your Honor. There's nothing to verify that there was actually a knowing, intelligent waiver.
What about the certificate of counsel? So we're at a proceeding. He's there with his public defender. At the start of the proceeding, the court, the public defender says that the interpreter needs to go over it with him, apparent reference to the form. The interpreter says, would you like me to go over it with him outside? And then the decision was made to pass the case, and then comes back in, and then he's asked, was it explained to him in Spanish? Yes. Did he discuss it with his attorney? Yes. And the attorney signs a certificate of counsel indicating that she believed the defendant understood the document in its entirety and a number of other representations. Is there any evidence to suggest that there was any misunderstanding by the defendant in these circumstances?
There's no evidence to show that affirmatively that he actually understood the difference between a judge trial and a jury trial, that he would have had a right to 12 jurors to participate in jury selection.
Well, he signed the form, and he indicated that he'd signed the form, did he not? So my question to you, is there any evidence to suggest that the representations that were made, that they were going to go outside, review the form with him in the Spanish language, that he reviewed the form, that it was explained to him in Spanish, and that his attorney certified for the court that she believed he understood the document? Given all those representations, is there anything to indicate that he didn't understand the form?
Well, there is, if you look at the interaction between the court at the end towards the sentencing, the court asked two questions, and he seemed puzzled that he didn't understand what he was really being asked.
And he asked the court a question at that time, right?
Yes.
This is now later when the trial has occurred, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so when he didn't understand, he asked the court a question, right?
Yes.
Did he ask the court a question when he was going over this form?
No, he did not.
And the court asked, did he have any questions for me? And he said no.
Yes.
So despite the fact that at sentencing he showed he was quite willing to speak up and ask a question when he had a problem understanding the court, he didn't do so here.
That's after the changed circumstance of being convicted. And his first thing that he stated very boldly to the court was that I didn't do anything to this woman. I've never done anything to anyone in the state. He professed his innocence right after the conviction. And I think that is the most compelling statement that he made. Right after the conviction, he said that he never did anything to this woman or to anyone else in the state. And I think that's really telling as to what was in his mind at the time. And it's not, the police reports, of course, aren't part of the record, but the police reports indicated that the complaining witness had no visible injuries, that there were police officers that knew this, that it was reported so many days later. If this case was remanded for a new jury trial, it would make the world of difference between the outcome in the first trial and the second trial, because none of those police officers who observed no injuries on the day of the event were ever listed on the defense counsel's witness list. They were never called as witnesses. The government never called them as witnesses.
So that would mean he would get another chance to do some of the things that the attorney didn't do the first time if we were to vacate on this ground. That's correct. What is the rule you're advocating for? Would it be that whenever there's a defendant who has to have an interpreter or the assistance of an interpreter, that a written waiver could never be adequate?
No. I believe that because this is such an important right, and that the court has implemented the Tachibana colloquy, and because of the repeated failure of the knowing, intelligent, voluntary waiver of the right to testify, that this should be not only implemented in this case, but really a clear line rule needs to be implemented, because the court has mentioned in the Friedman case and then the subsequent cases that the court would not impose a bright line rule, but this issue keeps coming up again and again, and the courts are not, especially on the neighbor island, if you look at all the cases that come to this court on appeal, that most of the right to jury trial and whether or not there's a waiver, knowing, intelligent, voluntary, are coming from the Big Island and from the island of Maui.
So are you proposing a bright line rule now?
Yes, that's
what. What is that rule that you're proposing?
That would be that, as the court pointed out, what was apropos in the Friedman case, that the court would have those four factors, the difference between a judge trial and a jury trial. Those four factors that were discussed in the Friedman case should be implemented to ensure that the waivers are voluntary. And with such an important constitutional right, if we already do this in the Tachibana colloquies that are done twice in each trial that I've done myself as trial counsel, why not include this?
Your bright line is that the form itself does not suffice, that the court judge has to do it on the record. Is that your argument?
Yes, because the waiver is the court is directed to ensure that the client's waiver is knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. It's kind of like the jury instructions. It's directed to the court to make sure, the trial court, that the jury instructions are accurate.
Are you also arguing that if the form is going to suffice, then we don't need the Tachibana colloquy anymore? All we need is interpreters to go over a waiver of right to testify on a form that the defendant can then sign, and that would be sufficient if we don't require the judge to do this in open court?
I don't think that would be sufficient, Your Honor. I think it really needs, the defendant himself has to articulate back to the court what his understanding is, because without the defendant articulating in his own words what those four things mean to him, there's no really way to ensure that it's knowing, intelligent, and voluntary.
If we find a form sufficient, then we could allow other waivers just through a form with an interpreter going over a form.
In this case, I think one thing that's important to note that there is nothing in the record to support that the defense counsel and the interpreter went over the form together. If you look, it appears, it's hard to tell, but it looks like the defense counsel stayed in the courtroom and the interpreter went outside and interpreted this form.
So your view is that the certification by the assistant public defender, deputy public defender, that I certified, I have read and explained fully the foregoing, that I believe the defendant understands this document in its entirety, that those representations were false?
Nothing to support that. That was contemporaneous with the waiver, and it should have been contemporaneous with the waiver. There's nothing in the record to support. That could have been an earlier conversation between defense counsel and Luis Gomez-Lovato. There's nothing to support that that was done on the day that the...
I have read and explained fully the foregoing. So your concern is that this might have taken place at some other time?
Yes, Your Honor. There's nothing in the record to support when it was, and...
Other than the fact that the court said go outside and review the form, right? Or that appears to have been what happened.
Said to the interpreter. Actually,
well, the interpreter said, shall we go outside and interpret and review the form, is what I recall.
Who's Ms. Lawson?
She was the defense counsel at the time, and now I understand she works for the prosecutor.
All right, so she said somebody has to go over the form?
Yes, she said, but the interpreter needs to go over it with him. That was her statement to the court, correct?
Yes, so that's correct. That the interpreter needs to go over it with him, and it's really the attorney who's supposed to ask the questions, with the interpreter being the mode of communication with the client. And there's nothing in this record to support that Ms. Lawson did that. And the interpreter actually asked, would you like me to go over it with him outside? And then the prosecutor spoke up and said, Mr. Disher, I suggest passing this case. So rather than taking care of it right then and there, when everyone was present in the courtroom where it could have been interpreted, it was what I would describe as a rush job, and not taking the time to ensure this knowing, voluntary, intelligent.
How do you know it was a rush job? I mean, was in another interpretation of this that the prosecutor is simply saying, why don't we pass this case so we can go out and take our time reviewing the form, so we're not sitting here while there were 17 cases on the calendar, we know that many at least, sitting here with a whole bunch of other people in the courtroom staring at them while the form's being interpreted, why not go outside and do it outside? Isn't that at least another possible interpretation of what was going on here?
Well, there's nothing to support that at the time.
There's nothing to suggest it's a rush job either, though. I mean, or what is, what's the evidence that it was somehow rushed?
At the time, there was nothing put on the record between the court and the defendant to show that he understood exactly what he was waiving, that he even understood what the difference between a jury trial and a judge trial is. All this happened outside of the court's presence, and there's no way to ensure that the judge ensured the voluntariness, the intelligence.
Other than asking him whether it was explained to him in Spanish and having him confirm, asking him whether he understood it and having him confirm. Your position is the court should have done a colloquy with him, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. And that would have cured any potential for this appeal issue, and it would make a lot of these issues, as the court pointed out.
And that should be done in every case, not just a case of someone who speaks a language other than English?
Yes. I believe that if we take that effort now in the Tachibana colloquy, that there's no reason not to do the same in this, whether or not the person speaks a different language or not, because if you look at some of the cases where the court pointed out that there is a waiver, there was some interaction with the defendant actually articulated in their own words what that waiver meant to them. And
so
that's...
I understand your point of view that you feel that the defendant should articulate on the record that he does not want a jury trial. I do have a problem with your statement that there's nothing in the record that indicates that he understood. When we have an attestation by his attorney saying that she believed that the defendant understands the document and the statements contained therein, that's in the record. Are you suggesting to us that we're supposed to discount it? Or because it is part of the record. Or is it not to be believed?
Well, there's nothing to explain the extent of his understanding.
Explain fully the foregoing? and the defendant understands the document, she is swearing to that.
And I know she was, but there's nothing that he actually understood what that difference was. That was his first time in a court of law.
I believe the defendant understands the document in its entirety.
And that's what she said. She believed, but there's nothing in the record to support that. To me,
in a change of plea colloquy, does the judge go over the defendant's rights to trial, including the right to jury trial?
Yes, slowly and methodically.
And does the judge explain that by pleading guilty or no contest, the defendant is waiving what rights to a jury trial that defendant is waiving?
Yes.
So if we adopt the state's position in this case that the form is sufficient, we can dispense with on-the-record colloquies and changes of plea too. Do you think that that would be the result of this case?
Well, I think that the change of plea form is a lot more detailed than the form that was used in this case in the colloquies that take
but
place.
But still, yes, with a change of plea, the judge does a colloquy on the record, whether it's an interpreted case or not.
That's correct. And it's a much more detailed colloquy.
Right.
And in those guilty pleas, there are these same certifications, right?
Yes.
But does the judge say to counsel, counsel, did you go over this form? In other words, the court doesn't simply accept this written certification.
That's correct.
So the court, in fact, in court, asks counsel himself or herself whether she did, in fact, do what's certified.
And additionally, the court also asks the defendant, do you understand this?
And well, and he also asks the defendant, you know, are you satisfied with counsel? But looking at the certificate, we have to take it in the context, I assume, that since defendant needed an interpreter, that it wasn't counsel who was interpreting.
That's correct.
So if counsel, we can assume, doesn't speak Spanish, to what extent could he certify that he explained fully to the defendant and he believes the defendant understands the document in its entirety? To what extent can we accept that kind of certification?
That's where I believe the speculation comes in at the counsel.
This is a form certification.
Yes.
And it appears in all these pleadings. And it's never been seen to suffice, as in this case where the court never even asked the counsel
yes.
about the certification.
Well, what about if it were in court? How would we know that the interpretation was accurate in court? Assuming the judge doesn't speak the Spanish language, doesn't speak Spanish, how would the judge know if the interpretation is being done improperly in court? Are you advocating we should have backup interpreters to check the accuracy of the interpreters?
No, Your Honor, because the Friedman case points out that in the Friedman case, the defendant actually articulated back what the difference was between a judge's trial and a jury trial. So that was...
Now what if that in the case of an interpreted defendant who's being interpreted, if the flaw in the system is having an interpreter speak rather than counsel, how is doing it on the record in court any different if you don't know whether that interpreter is doing it accurately or not?
Well, in this case, there was two salient facts. There was his first time in court, and the second is the language barrier. But then there's not a colloquy that the defendant actually articulated in his own words, and very similar to the federal case.
Counsel, if the court relies simply on the affirmation in court about the interpreter, then how do we know that what the interpreter said to the defendant was what the defendant should have understood?
Without the defendant saying it back, there's no way to ensure that.
Well, assuming that that's the case, then who in this scenario, in this event, would be able to ascertain that in fact what the interpreter said to the defendant was what he should have been able to understand? Who would have to confirm that or ascertain that?
Well, it's the court asks the question to the defendant, and then the defendant responds speaking through his interpreter. That's done.
And if the court doesn't do that, then who's doing the job of explaining the defendant's rights to the defendant?
It's actually the interpreter and not the court.
And do we certify interpreters with respect to what the duties of a judge would be, saying in this particular case they seem to be acting as a substitute for what the court should be doing, as to what the duty and obligation of someone who acts in the place of a judge should be in terms of waiving the right to a jury trial?
No, Your Honor. And the interpreter is simply asking court whether or not you will translate everything accurately.
Is it sufficient to simply ask someone, did the interpreter explain the form to you?
Does that
indicate that the defendant, through that explanation, not knowing what the interpreter said, et cetera, and not confirming what the interpreter explained to the defendant, that by that process the defendant would understand what his rights would be?
I don't believe it's the interpreter's job. It's the court's job.
How do we confirm that the interpreter is doing the job the interpreter is supposed to do with respect to explaining this form?
Well, when the person comes back in with the form for the court to ask the defendant through the interpreter, what does this mean to you that you're going to give up your right to a jury trial, that you're not going to have 12 members?
And if the court doesn't do that, then what have we decided or ascertained with respect to the defendant's understanding of this right?
That there's no knowing, intelligent waiver. There's no way to ensure that without the defendant articulating back in his own words exactly what it means to him.
Actually, in this, you know, if this had been done in court, there would have been a tape recording as to what was said, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
In fact, there was no court reporter in this case. A lot of these family court abuse and family abuse of household member cases, there is no court reporter, and all the proceedings are tape recorded, correct?
But that's correct, Your Honor.
And isn't it also true that there's many cases in which defendants challenge the interpretation based on the accuracy of the interpretation based on the tape recording?
Yes. And we all see the blank lines that come up on appeal in so many cases, inaudible in those words in parentheses with so many.
But so if it's not done on the record, we have no idea what was actually interpreted outside of court.
That's correct. In the on-the-record colloquy, just as in the Tachibana, I think this is more closer to the Tachibana colloquy, that it should be implemented that way, because the right to testify or remain silent is, to me as a defense counsel, on equal par with the right to a jury trial. And as the court pointed out in the Wong v. Among case, that with a silent and minimal record, the burden's on the prosecution to prove the knowing and voluntary waiver, and I don't think the government is able to do that.
The ICA seemed to put the burden on the defendant to show that it was a non-voluntary waiver. That was the language that the ICA used. Is that correct?
Yes, by a preponderance of the evidence, which it actually is contradicted by the Wong versus Wong case, 52 Hawaii 420, a 1970 case, citing Boykin versus Alabama.
I thought you agreed in your cert app that with that burden, it said you carried the burden and demonstrated by a preponderance of the evidence that his waiver was involuntary. That comes from the Friedman case, correct?
That's correct, but I believe that it's been flushed out enough that the record in this case is silent or minimal, that the court should implement the Wong versus Among standard in deciding this.
In this case, there's nothing
to
do with
standard.
Excuse me. Oh, go ahead.
The Wong versus Among case, the 52 Hawaii 420 1970, where the burden's on the government if it's a silent or minimal record.
And this isn't a voluntariness issue, it's a knowing and intelligent issue, and it's a judge who makes a determination that the court concludes the defendant knowingly, voluntarily, intelligently waived the right to jury trial.
Yes.
And the judge never asked a single question or informed him of a single. In fact, the only time he even mentions the word jury, apparently, is when he references the form.
Yes. And that's what concerns me as a defense counsel who's a court appointed in these cases, that it doesn't seem too much just to ask for this extra attention to be given to this important fundamental constitutional right, that is just as important as the right to remain silent or testify. We also have the issue with the sentencing.
Well, how much time does... I know we've been asking you a lot of questions, so I'll undoubtedly give you some more time, but just to get a sense of where we're at, 30 seconds. Well, do you want to wrap up, and then we'll have we'll hear from Ms. Walton, and then I will give you some more time in rebuttal.
Yes. I'll just wrap up with a few brief points. It's important to remember, too, that when he did do his waiver of jury trial, it was for a complaint that stated the offense occurred on September 23rd. Later, when it went to trial, it was actually an amended complaint that said the 24th or 25th. And at the time he waived his right to jury trial, it was for a different event transaction than he actually went to trial on. So I want to point that out. With the sentencing, I believe that the writ sufficiently briefs the cases with the Nunes and the Binge case and the subsequent cases that the court took uncharged misconduct. It said that Mr. Luis Gomez Lobato lied, which is equivalent to a perjury charge, and that the charge could have been charged as attempted murder, which is a Class A felony. So, and the court actually punished him harsher, as indicated by the 30-day sentence that was given ultimately, rather than the 48-hour minimum for the first offense.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll hear from Ms. Walton now.
I do have a prepared statement I'd like to give, but one of your questions, Justice McKenna, I have a different answer to, and that is about the plea form in circuit court when a person pleads. That plea form does not advise what a jury consists of. It doesn't advise 12 people, doesn't advise unanimous, and it doesn't advise you have a right to participate in jury selection. None of those three things are in the standard plea form that's used in circuit court for felonies.
Yeah, the circuit court form, though, goes into all of the rights that the person would be waiving. You know, you're giving up the right to remain silent. You're giving up the right to the of the government having to prove your guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. You're giving up the right to jury, etc.
It says a lot of those things, but it doesn't say those specific things that Justice McKenna asked about. That's all I wanted to point out. Now I'd like to give my little argument. First of all, the Hawaii Rules of Penal Procedure, Rule 5B3, states that a waiver of jury can occur if the defendant waives it in writing or orally. So if the court doesn't feel this is appropriate, it should have changed the rule, basically, because the district courts have been relying on the penal rules of penal procedure, which specifically says it can be either in writing or orally.
If they literally relied on that rule, we wouldn't even have a transcript.
Wouldn't it be
way more efficient? Well, if you say that waiver can take place by writing, then all you need to do is file a waiver.
And that, like that's
you
been
do,
done
like
in some
you do in, like you do in civil cases. That, you just file a written waiver if we were to take that
rule
literally.
That has been done in some, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
But that has been done in some criminal cases, and in fact, there was another case before the ICA where there was only a written waiver that occurred in circuit court.
I look forward to the appeal from those cases.
Pardon?
I look forward to the appeal from those cases.
I think it's too late for cert on that case.
Oh.
But the point is that the rules should be clear because district courts try to follow the rules. And I think Judge Florendo, in devising the form he devised, clearly tried to follow the rule. He tried to follow what the four things that are supposed to be in there, which are all in there.
Is there any constitutional right that can be waived simply by filing a written form?
Well, that's what your rules of penal procedure state. So if you don't think that that's true, then I guess the rules of penal procedure should have been changed.
But is there anything in any of the cases that have said all you need to do is to file a written waiver and that will satisfy?
As I said, and the ICA did, and I'm trying to remember the name of the case, but I'm sure if you looked at waiver of jury trial in ICA, it's within the last 2 years. There was one where there was only a written waiver, and the ICA said that's okay. And I might point out that in that case, I did not strongly urge the ICA to do that, as I am urging this court to stick with what the judge did in this case. It was the ICA's decision independently of my brief. So anyway, the form that the Judge Florendo devised has the four factors in Duarte Higuereta. It has the certification of counsel, which was recommended by the court in Valdez. So the court clearly is trying to comply with the rules by coming up with this form. Friedman specifically said there's no bright line rule in Hawaii. Spratling said that in addition to the basics, we consider the following: whether there's representation by capable counsel, number one, whether there's a finding by the court, by the judge, that there was a waiver, and in this case there was, because Judge Ohuna found a waiver, and whether the defendant indicated he understood his rights, which he did in this case, through the interpreter.
Spratling, not that it's determinative, didn't involve an interpreter, did it?
It did not, you're correct.
By the way, in Spratling, did the court ever advise the defendant that if the defendant went with a jury trial, that the jury had to render a unanimous verdict?
In Spratling?
Yes.
I know they left out one of the factors or more, and it might have been that was the one they left out. I don't remember which one they left out, but I know they left out.
And so that's acceptable to you that you would leave out one of those four factors? If you went to, you had the defendant before you and you said to the defendant, well, there's factor one, factor two, factor three, and you don't mention factor four, would that mislead the defendant with respect to waiving his right to a jury trial?
It possibly could, but I consider myself bound by the opinions of this court and the ICA, so
just a question. This is a question.
Yes. Yeah. But in this case, I think the court didn't leave anything out. It had everything that was required in the form, everything.
Do you think that the fact that English was a second language to Mr. Gomez-Lovato should be taken into consideration?
Of course it should be taken into consideration, but this, if you look at the Duarte Higuereta case, in that case, there was nothing on the record to indicate that it had been translated at all into Spanish. In this case, both the defense counsel certified and the defendant said it had been translated into Spanish. So this is a far different case from Duarte Higuereta. And I think that the defendant's second language, having English as a second language, or perhaps not even a second language, I don't know, I think that has to be taken into consideration, but I think what's in the form, the fact that there was a translator there, the fact they took time to go off the record so that it could be translated.
Was the interpreter accurate in his or her translation of the form?
Well, Your Honor, I think the only way to know if an interpreter is accurate is if you had a second interpreter there interpreting back in the English what the other person says. That's going to be a
big
difference.
Could you do that? Could you check on the interpretation another way?
If there was an accurate recording, you could check on.
Well, we assume.
I'm sorry. Well, couldn't the judge ask a few simple questions?
Well,
couldn't the judge engage the individual and just say, you understand what a jury is? Well, the same way the court explains guilty plea and go through maybe 30 questions rather than just three or four. What would be the difficulty of just the judge asking each individual right and asking the person about it? You understand that a jury is composed of 12?
Are you saying asking 30 questions instead of three or four?
No, I'm saying for a jury trial waiver, it may only take four or five questions, okay? In a guilty plea, it takes 25 or 30 round figures. So I'm asking, what's the difficulty here to verify whether this has been interpreted correctly by just asking the defendant a few simple questions?
I think the only difficulty is that we would need more district court judges if we were to do that. I don't know how long it's been since some of you were in district court, but in district court in Kona, it's a very crowded situation, a very unruly situation, a very time-consuming situation.
When are these waivers taken? Only when the defendant is indicating that he or she is prepared to go to trial without a jury. These waivers are actually only taken at the time that it's very clear that there's not going to be a change of plea and that they're going to go to trial, correct? So actually, there's not that many waivers of jury trial.
That's incorrect.
Except when people are actually ready to go to trial.
No, that's incorrect, because in district court, at least in Kona, I don't know about Honolulu, but at least in Kona, in district court, you get the waiver of jury trial before you have the pretrial conference. It's at the pretrial conference where it's decided if the plea offers.
You're saying that the Kona courts are routinely obtaining waivers of jury trial in these cases, even if the defendant hasn't decided whether or not he or she wants to plead?
I think that is occurring, yes.
Then isn't that what is taking unnecessary time, obtaining waivers from 17 defendants before discussing plea agreements?
I assume that may take a lot of time, but I assume also if you tried to see that you didn't get a waiver of jury trial until trial was already scheduled, you'd have another delay and you'd also have more arguments to the contrary.
Thank you for alerting us to the difference in practice and procedure between the different circuits.
But this occurs at the time when the defendant enters a guilty plea or not guilty. That's what happened here, right?
I believe so. I would have to check the transcript to be sure, but I believe that's true.
But what you're saying is it doesn't occur. There's a subsequent, the pretrial conference or the trial setting conference.
I know, in this case the pretrial conference was scheduled after the waiver of jury trial because it says that in the transcript specifically.
So here the transcript, his counsel said he would be entering a not guilty plea and requesting a pretrial conference setting, and then he needs to execute a waiver of jury trial form as well.
Yes.
So is that your understanding? The typical situation is at the time of plea, either entering a guilty or not guilty plea for the first time is when this matter is addressed.
That's basically.
So basically, in this court, you can't get the judge to discuss a potential Rule 11 plea agreement unless you waive your right to jury trial.
I don't know that anybody's ever asked the judge to discuss a Rule 11 agreement, but in fact, I have to say that in practice, although Rule 11 agreements are somewhat common in one of our circuit courts, the other of our circuit court judges, Judge Ibarra, almost never gives a Rule 11. Judge Florendo almost never gives a Rule 11 because they don't approve of it policy-wise, I believe, except in rare cases.
Just for clarification as well, then it couldn't possibly be a first appearance, could it? Because first appearance is arraignment.
It wouldn't be.
It would have to be set so that you could schedule an interpreter to be there. Right?
Well, what usually happens is, like a person, if they come to court without an attorney to begin with, they're usually given a continuance to come back. At the time they come back, they're supposed to enter a plea and make a decision about the waiver of jury trial. And there might be a third time they come back if they need an interpreter, because we don't always have an interpreter available every day.
In fact, the record here shows the public defender saying, at the last hearing we needed an interpreter present, which I believe she is now. So apparently there was some prior proceeding, but there was no interpreter at that time.
Right, and so then I think Judge Florendo's standard practice is if there's no interpreter, he doesn't do anything. He waits till the interpreter gets there, and then he does what he would normally do.
If the purpose was really only for a plea, enter a plea, and set for a conference, why wasn't there have been a knowledge ahead of time that the defendant was going to waive his right to jury trial? Why would you need an interpreter just to enter? Because at an arraignment, you can just enter a plea not guilty and set for jury trial.
I think it's because of the because usually at the time of entry of plea, there's also a decision on waiver or demand jury trial. It's usually done at the same time, the entry of plea. And it doesn't have to be done the first time. Judge Florendo always gives people a chance, like 30 days, to come back and tells them to apply to the public defender before they come back. So they have ample time to make that decision. Next important point is that the defendant bears the burden to show by a preponderance that a waiver was involuntary. Now, in this case, there's not a word by the defendant that he didn't understand. Perhaps
are we confusing our voluntariness with knowing intelligence? Because you just said something about there's nothing here showing he didn't understand. Voluntariness is a different determination.
I'm not talking about voluntariness of statements. I'm talking about what the cases say, that it's the cases from Friedman, Myers, Barros. They all say it's the defendant's burden to show by a preponderance that the waiver of jury trial was involuntary. That's the words they use, not my words. In this case, there's no showing. There could have been like a Rule 40, if he really didn't understand it, there could have been a Rule 40 filed saying, oh, I didn't understand this. Then we could have called as witnesses the interpreter. We called, because it could have called as a witness the public defender, Ms. Lawson. And the court could have made an evaluation based on the totality of the circumstances, which it's required to do under Friedman, as to whether there really was an involuntary or a voluntary waiver. But this defendant hasn't even ever said he didn't understand this. Not once in the record. He had a chance to do it at the pretrial conference. He had a chance to do it at trial. He didn't do it once. He didn't file Rule 40. And I think when all the cases say it's his burden to demonstrate that the waiver was involuntary, we should at least require him to say that, at the very least, and give the state the opportunity to call the witnesses it could call to rebut his assertion. And in this case, the witness would be the interpreter and the defense counsel.
Doesn't the law require that a constitutional right, there has to be a demonstration on the record of a knowing and intelligent waiver of the constitutional right?
Apparently not, because that's not what any of the cases have said. Again, in State versus Ebo.
So if that were the case, that in order to show a valid waiver, the burden is on the government to show that the waiver was intelligently, knowingly, and voluntarily made, that if you assume that's true, then this appeal, it would be a valid appeal?
I am not sure.
You're raising all kinds of barriers to him raising this question. Oh, he should have gone to Rule 40. You should have had a hearing below where we would be able to call witnesses, etc. So you're raising all these barriers to this rule that says the government must, on the record, establish that the waiver was intelligently, knowingly, and voluntarily made, and that would be sufficient to raise a point on appeal.
Well, I think under all the case law that this court and the ICA have issued before on this subject, The record is much clearer in this case than it was in Spratling. It's much clearer that it was in Myers. It's much clearer than it was in Valdez. All these cases, our record is much clearer than any of those cases. And yet,
I don't have that language before me, but if we assume that the burden is on the government to prove waiver, that waiver took place on the record, knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily, that issue can be raised on appeal after conviction.
Well, of course it can be raised on appeal.
Without having to file a Rule 40 or having to have, in effect, a voluntariness hearing where you can call witnesses.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say without filing a Rule 40, because based on our existing case law.
Any of the cases you cite talk about having a Rule 40 as a precondition to raising this issue, or
no,
having a voluntariness hearing before being able to raise this issue?
They don't, but what all the cases I cite.
You know why they don't?
I don't know, because I didn't write the opinions. But what all those cases do say is there's much more omitted in each of those cases than was omitted in this case about what the defendant was advised of. Much more omitted.
The defendant wasn't advised any aspect of the jury trial whatsoever by the judge.
But the judge gave the interpreter the time to advise him of it using the form.
Can the judge delegate the judge's authority to the court interpreter or even to an attorney in determining whether or not someone knowingly and intelligently waives? Isn't that the court's responsibility?
I think the court did carry out that responsibility by, after the written waiver, because it was clear from the record, the written waiver was in the defense attorney's hands when we started the proceeding. There was going off the record to allow the interpreter to explain it. After that, the defense attorney and the interpreter and the defendant all came back in together. Defense attorney signed the certification.
Wouldn't a proper finding by the judge, instead of saying, I find that the defendant has knowingly and intelligently waived his right to a jury trial, maybe the proper ruling would have been, I find that the interpreter has indicated that the interpreter explained that right to him and that the lawyer signed a form. That's all the judge could have actually indicated. The judge could not find a knowing intelligent waiver because there was no engagement of the defendant.
Again, I think it's the court's responsibility, if you ask me, to change its rule if it's going to impose that. The court shouldn't have a rule one way and then say, you did wrong.
It's difficult to
just follow the rule.
It's difficult to accept that premise when all our case law says this is a constitutional right. In light of a constitutional right, you know, the rule really has no viability, vitality.
Well, I would ask you to search in the ICA, because that opinion that I was telling you about is within the last 2 years, and it was solely on a written waiver. And I actually took your position almost, not quite as much as you took it, but I almost took your position. But,
thank you.
It's too bad you didn't go to the committee, the Penal Rules Committee, and advocate for a rule change.
Ms. Walton, assuming State v. Spratling and State v. Mitchell both say that it's the court should, the reviewing court should look at the totality of the circumstances in determining whether there's a valid waiver, how does the fact that this is an interpreted waiver play into the totality of the circumstances?
Well, I think to look at the totality of the circumstances in this case, that's all the more reason why you'd need to challenge it in a Rule 40 proceeding, because you could get on the record then the interpreter's testimony of what she told the defendant. You could get on the record the defense attorney's statement about what she discussed with the defendant. So I think the fact that there's an interpreter might be all the more reason.
So this issue in a misdemeanor conviction should not be raised on appeal. And so if the conviction is sustained, not overruled, then the defendant can go ahead and serve his sentence and then file a Rule 40 after he's served his 30 days?
I don't know the answer to that. I assume you get to stay on appeal, so I assume perhaps you could.
The Rule 40 should be tracked, should be done at the same time as the appeal, and we hope that the judge will actually hear it before we decide the appeal?
I would say ideally, yes, that would be reasonable, but I'm not sure if there's, if there can be simultaneous proceedings, I doubt it.
Let me ask you this, Ms. Walton. It's the same question I asked Mr. Luiz. Is there anything in the record here to indicate that this defendant was not communicating effectively through his interpreter with the court?
Nothing whatsoever. And in fact, in the subsequent trial, he was able to express his position and he was able to challenge the court's findings. So I think when Judge Ona specifically asked him, do you have any questions for me, if he really didn't understand, he could have said, yeah, I have questions. What is it I'm doing here?
Would a conviction or the facts adduced at trial vitiate the violation of a constitutional right? In other words, do we set aside that right if at trial it proves, the trial says the guy's guilty?
I'm having a hard time following that.
Having a hard time following your answer. If
we
can say, if we say at the end of trial that, you know, he must have understood because he was able to stand up and say, I didn't do it, it never happened. Right. Does that vitiate the assertion of a constitutional right?
I don't think it vitiates the assertion of a constitutional right.
In other words,
right.
Do you give up your right if to the Constitution if at trial you are convicted and you're able to defend yourself?
No, I don't think you give up your right because of that, but it's one of his ability to express himself through an interpreter is one of the factors to be considered in the totality of circumstances. That's all I say.
Does the record reflect whether or not this defendant had the same interpreter at the time of change, waiver and at the time of trial?
I I don't have the first transcript with me, so I can't answer
that. I think it was Gabriella Cooper at the first proceeding and Elizabeth Schick at the second proceeding,
okay.
I believe is what the transcript shows.
Thank you. So in other words, from the trial proceedings, we don't know whether the, because the defendant did testify at trial, but we don't know what the communication level was as to the first interpreter based on the trial.
You could say that. Yeah. The next thing that I'd like to address is that the change in the date from the complaint to the amended complaint should not affect the waiver. As Judge Florindo found at the transcript 39, page 68, he almost found that this occurred on the 23rd, which was the original complaint. The prosecutor pointed out that that the date was actually the 24th, and Judge Florindo pointed out that the exact date is not an element of the offense. So it wasn't a different transaction that he was fighting. It's just that the state had made a mistake in the complaint about the date of the offense.
What about the argument made here that there is evidence in the record that the court held the defendant responsible for uncharged crimes, because normally the sentence is 48 hours in jail, and he got 30 days in jail?
Well, Your Honor, the idea that he was found responsible for uncharged crimes is ludicrous, really. Attempted murder carries a life imprisonment sentence. He didn't get life imprisonment. He didn't even get the maximum for the offense of abusive household. So clearly, the Judge Florindo was not sentencing for attempted
murder.
What's
the max for abusive?
1 year, and he got 30 days. Okay. So I don't think the judge was sentencing him for attempted murder. As to the contention that the judge was sentencing him for perjury, perjury is a Class C felony, which carries a 5-year sentence. Again, he wasn't sentencing him for perjury.
Well, I think the whole idea was that he was using, these acts as a proxy for those types of offenses.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think as to the perjury, all he said is that your testimony is full of inconsistencies, if not outright lies. Now, the judge that tries a case has a duty to find the facts, and that's what he found. He found that the victim was credible, the defendant was not credible. And he might have said it in colorful terms, but that's what he was saying. One's credible, you're not credible. And that doesn't mean he was sentencing him for perjury. Certainly doesn't mean he was sentencing him for murder. I don't know. Any other questions on that point? I think that's all that I have.
Thank you very much, Ms. Walton. Ms. Louise, your rebuttal. Do you think 5 minutes would be adequate for you to cover the points you need to cover? Would 5 minutes be adequate for you to cover the points that you need to cover? Okay. We'll have our bailiff keep a time for 5 minutes then.
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor. I will note the difference in the transcripts between the December 22nd, 2010, and the March 9th, 2011. There's nothing to indicate in the original waiver of the jury trial issue whether or not the interpreter was sworn in, because when you look at the trial date, actually is asked to the interpreter, you solemnly swear to interpret from English into the Spanish language and from the Spanish language into English to the best of your knowledge and ability. But that's not reflected in the transcript with the waiver of the jury trial, because they have so many cases. It's just speculation or assuming that it was done, but there's nothing to indicate when I ordered the transcript for this case that was actually done, that question was actually given to the interpreter. So I'll point that out. With the response to the Rule 40, the defendant has to exhaust his direct appeal before he can ever raise a Rule 40. That's the standard established by the case law. So it would be ludicrous to suggest that the defense should have to do a Rule 40 to determine whether or not his waiver of constitutional right to jury trial was knowing, intelligent, and voluntary in a Rule 40. And in this case, the defense counsel, Ms. Lawson, now works for the prosecutor's office, and it would be a real question as to whether or not she would be called as a witness in the case because she was actually the counsel that represented him as defense counsel at trial and at the time of the waiver of the jury trial, and now she works in the prosecutor's office, and there's a question as to what confidential information she secured while she was his defense counsel, and now she's in the prosecutor's, and whether or not she could be even screened it sufficiently to comport with all the rules involving conflict of interest. There's nothing to indicate in the record that at the time he waived his right to jury trial, whether there was even the benefit of the police reports that were available for the defense counsel to even go over those, because there's a big difference with whether you choose a jury trial or a judge trial, and a lot of that comes from the examination of the police reports. There's nothing in the record to indicate when the defense counsel actually had the police reports, so the question becomes, why is there such a rush that at such a simple task as whether you enter a guilty or not guilty plea, what's the rush to have the waiver of this right to jury trial done so early in the case when the trial is occurring months later? The Tachibana colloquy is actually done on the day of trial, so why not the right to the jury trial, that being decided pretty close proximity to the jury trial as well, enough time just to get the jury panels picked from the community and brought in. That would appear to present itself a much better rule to ensure that the defendant is not shortchanged of such an important constitutional right. With the case law, with reference to the District Court Rules 5B, the case law that interprets that rule still says that the waiver has to be knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. The rule does say you can have a written or an oral waiver, but it still has to be developed in the record that was knowing, intelligent, and voluntary.
Your position is a written waiver could never be knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. Isn't that right? Or is that not right?
That's not correct. If the form actually was...
Well, when could it be okay?
If it, in my... how I would articulate this, if the defendant actually, as in the Friedman case, articulated back to the court that he understood that he would not be getting a trial with 12 jurors, as in the Friedman case, that would be sufficiently that he actually knowingly, intelligently, voluntarily waived his right to a jury trial. So there has to be some articulation back by the defendant to show that he actually understands.
Although the rule appears to contemplate a waiver in writing or orally in open court. So the rule appears to contemplate situations in which a purely written waiver would be sufficient. Is it your position that that rule is constitutionally invalid, or that portion of the rule?
Well, the written waiver, even the form that's attached to the state's answering brief, is not sufficient to ensure that the court actually met its obligation to show that the defendant actually knowingly, intelligently understood this right. So that form that was attached to the state's instance.
So you would concede that if this was, for example, a professor from a country, a law professor who specializes in jury trials in the United States, and he or she was charged with a crime and signed the form, that could meet the totality of circumstances test?
That would be
under
just
Friedman?
One factor. Assuming that they have jury trials in that other country.
And it was on the record that this was his or her profession. As compared to this case, where we have, in terms of a totality of circumstances,
yes.
In terms of the transcript, I didn't see anything indicating, even in the trial, that anything that reflected the defendant's educational background.
Yes. I know that he's a landscaper in his profession, but I don't.
Well, we don't have anything to reflect his educational background.
That's correct.
Those are the kinds of factors that would play into the totality.
Yes, as pointed out in the Friedman case, and even that other case where it was discussed about the correction officer, that just because the person was a correction officer doesn't mean that he's going to understand the difference between a jury and a judge trial. And if the correction officer didn't understand that distinction, surely my client was not going to understand that well. There was also some, other issues just in the transcript. It says that the complaining witness was told by her attorney that she should present this case. Weeks had went by There was no sign, as the police indicated in the police reports, there was no signs of visible injuries on the date of the event. And then weeks later, she reported it, and it says in the trial transcript that she was told by her attorney, and I believe that was an immigration attorney that told her to go forward with this case, because when you take that in context of the defendant's profession of innocence at the very day of sentencing, where he was punished harshly, the court doesn't indicate there's any factor from the trial itself. The court never cited to any evidence from the trial that I believe you choked her or you hit her or you did something out of the ordinary that you should not get the simple 48 hours, which is the standard rule in a first offense. This 30-day is more standard with a subsequent offense, and that's what the statute 906 in subparagraph 5B actually states, that if it's a second offense within a year, that it would be a 30-day jail sentence.
Anything further? We've gone a bit over your rebuttal time already, so if you want to wrap up, that would any further points that you want to make, Mr. Ruiz?
Yes. I believe that in conclusion, with such an important constitutional right, that it would not be a burden on the state courts to make sure that these waivers are knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. That's just basically that scare argument that this will open the door to all this. But when you look at how many cases actually go to jury trial and how fast they go to jury trial, it's not really going to be that many cases that this is going to affect with this knowing voluntary waiver. And there's nothing in the record to indicate that the 706-606 factors were actually really considered. It was extraneous, attempted murder, and perjury that were considered by the court in imposing a harsh sentence. And my client waived his right to a jury trial at the most for something that occurred on September 23rd, but not the 24th.
Are you saying that there was an incident on September 23rd instead of just a mix-up? You're repeating what you said before, that he actually thinks there was something that happened on a different date that he was going to trial to defend on?
Well, I think that goes into the totality of the circumstance, whether he could actually waive his right to jury trial for something that was basically enhanced, that's over now 2 days from the original 1 day that he's accused of doing something.
Well, was there ever any suggestion there was anything other than the one incident, albeit with the date that had been confused in the charge?
There was with the police reports that...
In fact, how, as the case was tried?
Yes, that comes out in the transcript in the trial as to the events themselves, that it wasn't just... There was an event that occurred out the Outback in the parking lot, then subsequently she goes back to the house. There's another event.
The event at the parking lot was the encounter with the person who she was walking with, correct? And that set the stage for what happened at the house. Is that right?
That's what the claim by the complaining witness was.
Okay. Was that on the 23rd?
I'm not sure the exact date that actually occurred. I can look at the police report.
Is there any evidence that these were separate dates, the incidents occurred on separate dates? It's all in one day, right?
Yes. Well, within a 24-hour period, but it depends when you consider the date of start and end. It was shortly after 11 p.m. that the incident in the Outback parking lot occurred, and then she went back to the house, and then she claims other events transpired. He claims that
What was he charged with?
Abuse of a household family member.
Wait, for which incident?
For the incident at the house.
At the house.
Not in the parking lot.
Okay.
But she had called the WIC person and asked for that person to meet her in the parking lot. Then she called the police. The police came and did a visual inspection, found no injuries. And this was in the early morning hours within the incident in the Outback, which was indicated to not involve any act of violence.
Okay, thank you.
Well, counsel, I think you can assume we will read the record and we will understand. We don't allow sir rebuttals, Ms. Walton, and I'm just not going to vary from that rule. I'll just explain to counsel, we understand your representations to the court, but it's the court's duty to review the record and decide the case on the record, and we will review the record and decide the case based on what we see there. Really not, Ms. Walton, I'm sorry. You're tempting me, but you know, really, you know, I mean, it's just because we just don't take sir rebuttal and rebuttal.
It's not sir rebuttal, I'm just going to give you the name of the case that I need to
make. Well. What's the name of the case, Ms. Walton? You know what? No, I'm not. Forget it. You know, honestly, I'm just going to hold the rule. You know, I really appreciate it, but we'll find the cases. Believe me, we do a very thorough job of reviewing the record and reviewing the case law, and we'll have it. And we really appreciate your arguments today,
and the court will take this matter under advisement. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Please rise.